What's up, folks? It's the Shay Anything Podcast. Once again, another episode here on July 11th, 2018. Doug Williams alongside Andy Martino. As usual, it almost wasn't you.
It almost wasn't.
It was
almost
gonna be Nelson Figueroa.
But here I am. Next week, I won't be here on Wednesday. I'll be coming back from the All-Star game.
Wow.
So we'll have to make a real decision there if we're going to proceed without me or wait for me to return.
All systems go proceeding without you this week.
That's true.
Potential Wally
Nelson
situation.
Was going to co-host.
Yep.
But he's not. And here I am.
Would have been fine, just saying.
You know who would have liked that? Christy Ackert, the Daily News Mets beat reporter, who feels that I bullied you in our last podcast.
You bullied me?
She says so. She says.
By the way, she says
you should have stuck up for yourself.
Well, that's so.
But okay. She was on your side.
John Harper told me a story yesterday. He's at Citi Field walking around, and somebody goes up to him and says, I love the show, first of all. Second of all, you tell that Doug Williams to stick up for himself on Baseball Night in New York. Andy Martino and John Hine are so rude to him. Don't let him take that.
Her point was that you were right about the Braves being good. You could see them being good. I was making a point about the unpredictability of when teams get good. And you were like, you could see it coming with the Braves. And I was like, you idiots, you moron.
I don't remember that, but I will
I'll
start smacking you in the face.
She was like, Doug was right. You were wrong. And Doug should have been.
One of your coping mechanisms, not necessarily when you're wrong, but when you're presented by specifically me on an opinion that you disagree with, is to jokingly be like, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're stupid. End of discussion.
Maybe that's how I feel.
Well, it's best to hold those things in like an adult.
Eh.
Remember, we want to hear from you on all multi-platform programs. We have a Shay Hay for you this week, but in general, if you want to leave us a voicemail or a voice note or whatever, sny.tv/Shay, anything, we want to hear from you and answer some questions. We're going to be talking about two Mets employee positions this week.
Vice President of Ticket Sales.
Head of HR.
Senior Director of Human Resources.
The first one is the manager. And we're 2 days removed now from matchup gate.
How many matchup gates have there been this year?
Jerry Blevins, did Mickey Callaway purposefully jump the gun on Gabe Kapler to hopefully not have to face Odubel Herrera, blah, 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 blah. It was all very confusing. Mickey Callaway, basically what he said after the game, in my opinion, and I'm being slightly facetious here, Andy, is that he's basically revolutionized the way that managers change starting pitchers.
It was a big moment
in
baseball history.
Normally what happens, let's say late in a game, pinch hitter comes out on deck, which is what Odubel Herrera had done. And Mickey Callaway realizes he's got a lefty in the bullpen, and Herrera is 1-for-12 against that lefty. But Mickey Callaway came out before they announced Odubel Herrera into the game, which then allows Gabe Kapler the power to say, okay, who do I want to face Jerry Blevins?
Right.
Not Gabe Kapler saying, here's my hitter, what are you going to do?
Right.
So what Mickey Callaway did was put the power in Gabe Kapler's hands. I understand
or
Mickey.
Did he?
Well, yeah, that's the point. He has made this seem like he orchestrated it all along. And we had someone in our studio say yesterday, he was a little too prepared for that answer. So it was Steve Gelb's second question in the presser, and he was like, yeah, so here's what I was thinking.
Well, of course he was going to anticipate that, and they're going to prep him for that. That's how any manager.
Every beat writer's tweeting it out during the game, and someone says,
yeah,
hey, just so you know, you're going to have to answer for
this. Yeah, any communications professional would help him prepare his answer for a question that's expected. I mean, I'm not ascribing any ill motives to that.
No.
SOP. You know what that stands for?
No.
Standard operating procedure.
Right. I like that. I think there's nothing wrong with that. If something you do in the craziness of a baseball game gets picked up on Twitter, as this did, like legitimately every single person watching the Mets game was tweeting about it.
Right.
So I went back, actually, I was looking through the videos from this podcast that I've tweeted out over the last couple of months. On, I believe, the 30th of June, we were talking about, or no, it must have been, it may have been May 30th, but I can't remember. We were talking about the microscope that we were watching Mickey Callaway under ever since what happened in Cincinnati happened.
Lineup card gate.
Lineup card. Then there was Swarzak not being ready. And I actually.
Which is much later. That was recently. Right?
Yeah, that was recent. And then you had the fact that in that same game with Swarzak, he pitched, Mickey Callaway did, pitched to Josh Harrison with Felipe Vasquez, who's a relief pitcher, on deck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Gerry Cohen, right when that happened, said, there's a relief pitcher on deck. This may not be the best decision. I'm paraphrasing. So, Andy, are we, it's possible that both of these things are happening, but are we watching too closely and maybe more closely than we normally are, A, and B, is Mickey Callaway making more in-game errors than the average manager does?
Those are great questions, and it's important, obviously, to zoom out and make sure that we're not piling on. Mm-hmm. And we've been, I think, our tones on across our shows that we do have been fairly critical of Callaway, and rightfully so. There's been a lot of growing pains. But, yeah, look, in-game moves are very, very difficult for anyone to put a lot of scrutiny under, in my opinion. As a beat writer and columnist, I was always very reluctant to criticize any manager's in-game moves unless they were really, really, really obviously blunders because of the information that we don't have. And that, and what I mean by that, it's like someone's hurt or someone, there's a matchup maybe that I didn't realize. And now it's even more so with these advanced analytics that are proprietary to the team that can determine some non-traditional matchups and situations. So it is difficult to evaluate. I think with Callaway, all I base it on is that baseball people inside and outside the Mets have definitely been like, wow, the game does appear as if it's moving kind of fast for that guy so far.
Yeah.
Now, where Mets people have been is, as we've talked about before, fully aware of that and still invested in helping him. He's not in any kind of hot seat, I can tell you. He's not in risk of losing his job at all. They want to nurse him through this period of development. They know that it was only however many months ago, 8-10 months ago, that he was like the hot managerial candidate of the offseason. He was the one that a lot of teams wanted. So they're definitely not going to write him off, but these in-game things do seem valid. Once it comes down to specific things, I do have a hard time starting to talk about, well, this guy was ready and this was the matchup and this guy and this guy. It sort of becomes a lot of white noise to me. And you're like, sometimes Mickey was wrong. Sometimes he had a valid reason for something. But I will tell you this. When he did, and it was after the Swarzak one that you mentioned, getting Swarzak up late in the loss to Pittsburgh on June 27th, and was asked about it, which in a fair way, by a young reporter, and he said, famously, yeah. So how it works in baseball is, when the phone rings, the you know the pitcher's ready. If you're going to condescend to other people, you're going to get less rope, less leeway. And I think that they need to be, and he, and when I say they, I mean Mickey Callaway and the people who help him develop, both in terms of baseball strategy and communication strategy, need to be careful that if you have that kind of apparent contempt for people asking you questions, hide it better. Or even better yet, have less contempt for the people who are asking you questions, because that's their job. So this is a very long way of saying that I think that we're at risk of overstating some of his in-game stuff and piling on, but you're going to have less goodwill if you don't treat people in a professional manner.
This is a very random point, but yesterday or last night, Deadspin wrote about the Mickey Callaway matchup thing with Herrera and Blevins. And, you know, I'm scrolling through on Deadspin and I go down to the comments, which are sometimes amusing. And the first comment is one of the things, I'm paraphrasing, but it appeared to be a comment from somebody who used to live here. It said, one of the things I miss about New York is that the local broadcasters are very critical of their teams.
I would actually disagree with that, though. I think that they're simply fair, and so many other local broadcasters straight homers.
I don't know for sure that he said critical. I read it late last night. I don't remember his exact wording or hers. But and then they went on to say, you know, I live in Orlando now, and it's always overwhelming positivity when the Magic are down 48-0 in the second quarter. So I agree with your point 100%. I think it is fair to, when there's a relief pitcher on deck and the Mets are deciding to pitch to a former All-Star, to say, hey, this is happening and this is odd. And back to the quick matchup thing, Andy, I don't want to get too much into the minutia of it because neither of us has ever played professional baseball. Neither of us has tried to manage. But first of all, I don't think that this is actually what Mickey Callaway was doing. I think he went out too quickly and was covering up his tracks. Now,
you're saying you don't believe his explanation?
I don't believe his explanation. The main reason I don't believe his explanation is because the most important stat in that moment is matchup-based. It is, how is Herrera against Blevins? And guess what? Herrera is terrible against Blevins. 1-for-12. So I believe Mickey Callaway looked at that stat, and rightly so, said, I'm going to bring in Jerry Blevins. Hadn't realized that Herrera had been announced into the game yet. Having said that, that I don't believe Mickey Callaway's explanation, I do understand him coming out there and having an explanation that may not have been actually what was going through his head. But what I don't understand, Andy, is, or what I want to ask you is, would Mickey Callaway have been better off saying, yeah, my bad?
If that's true, absolutely.
You think so?
Oh, no, of course.
Because
you have to be genuine. You have to be real.
I agree with you. I would rather him be genuine. And look, we're all speculating because it's very possible that he did mean to do it. But at a certain point, how many times can a manager in this city come out after a game and say, yeah, my bad? I mean, that's what he did in Cincinnati, and I give him all the credit in the world for that. But at a certain point, accountability is one thing. But if you keep saying, yeah, I screwed this up, that's just screw-ups piling up. It's not honesty piling up.
Well, if you're secure, there's a deeper issue here. First of all, backing up, I'm not with you that I'm saying I don't believe him on that call. To me, it's like somebody said something, I have to take it at face value unless I really have evidence to the contrary, just personally. So we're not both agreeing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an opinion.
It's opinion. Not... So I'm not there, but to go along with your question, if he did screw that up, what's the best approach in answering the question? You got to be real. Your players will lose respect for you if they think that you're making excuses. You can't be a leader as someone who makes excuses. And if you're confident in yourself in any capacity, in any position, then you admit fault. Like if I screwed up a sentence in a story or a piece of information, I would go to my bosses and say, you know what, I screwed that up, sorry. And that earns you credibility.
Yeah.
That's how anyone should act. So if he believes that he screwed it up, then he should say it. I don't know that he does believe that. All I've heard is that his explanation, you know? But he's got to be more, even the lineup card thing that you mentioned, if you remember back to that post game, he, to me, did the bare minimum of being accountable. Mm-hmm. He said, the message is, you know, that's what you got to do. You got to go. And he was like, well, it's on me. Sort of buck stops with me kind of comment that he made. And then there were two or three follow-ups, which were totally legit, along the lines of, like, help me get this straight. What's the chain of custody for the lineup card? How could this happen? And he went from there into, like, yeah, so that kind of thing. He wasn't really interested in engaging it. So I think he... Yes, he needs to make sure he appears accountable. That's important to his players because they're expected to be accountable. Jerry Blevins hasn't been very good at getting lefties out this year, so he's being held accountable for that by being demoted in the bullpen pecking order. So the guy demoting him has to be accountable for whatever mistakes he might make.
Right. And to be totally honest with you, me not necessarily believing or maybe I'm being skeptical about the truth of the validity of what Mickey Callaway said after the game, his explanation, is less about Mickey Callaway and more about the fact that that just doesn't happen. It would be a new rookie manager doing something that no manager does.
Well, you know,
which is hard to believe on just a black and white scale that Mickey Callaway would, without an experienced manager with him in his dugout, say, I'm going to put the power in Gabe Kapler's hands. I know managers don't do this, but I'm doing it. That's why it's hard to believe. It's not personal to Mickey. I haven't seen that before. So it's difficult for me to accept that suddenly, randomly, in a 3-0 game in early July against, you know...
Against
the Phillies, I don't...
I understand why that would be difficult for you to accept. One of two things happened. He either did something really outside the box or bent over backwards to come up with some cockamamie cover-up story. One of those two things happened. He is known as a guy who is interested in... different ideas. Forget it. Yeah, I'm trying to play the devil's advocate. It's not easy.
Yeah.
I don't know. All I know is if I don't know that you got to take someone at face value unless they have evidence to the contrary. And that's where I feel like I have to leave this, even though nothing that you're saying, you know.
Yeah, I'm not saying.
You know what I mean?
I'm not saying I'm right and I have proof that Mickey Callaway was not telling the truth. And I'm not trying to. I don't know how to say this, but I'm not almost accusing Mickey Callaway of lying. I'm saying that I have a hard time believing what he's saying because of the situation.
And I do understand what you're saying about how many times can a New York manager say, I screwed up. I mean, I guess the answer is don't screw up that often.
We are but when you do admit it. Of accountability. Like, yeah. New Yorkers get that. But at a certain point, how many times can you be accountable?
And I come back to the condescending thing. It just gives you less leeway to screw up. And it puts the microscope on how you react when you do screw up. And you know, you have to... I saw Terry Collins answer tough questions and sometimes even, like, ridiculous questions by, like, he'd drawn a deep breath. You'd wonder if his head was going to explode, and then he'd answer the question.
Right.
Because it was part of his job. He didn't ever drop a, like, well, I've been in baseball for 40 years.
Right. And speaking of Terry Collins, actually, we got a tweet from Flushing Flash 11. If Terry Collins was managing the Mets, would they have a better record? I say yes, and I miss his passion for the game.
It's hard to say. I miss his passion for the game, too. I think Mickey Callaway has passion for the game. And yeah. Manifests in a different way. He's also a baseball lifer. I missed Collins' overt, outward passion, mm-hmm. the stuff that was in that viral video with the umpire that came out, the daily interactions with him. I don't know if they'd have a better record because I don't know how much I think a manager affects a record. I think there have
been
such...
Yeah, I don't know their war.
Right. It's impossible to determine. There's been forces that are so much bigger than Mickey Callaway that have to do with why the Mets are so bad this year. I think that Terry... I will say this. I'll never be able to come up with a win total for what this means, but I covered a number of seasons when the Mets were supposed to win like 65 to 70 games, and they won 73, 75, and they just had some oomph behind them and some momentum, and Terry did know how to motivate people, especially towards the beginning. I think he was a better manager at the beginning than he was at the end, but he did know how to squeeze a lot out of some pretty bad rosters. But I can't say definitively. There's so many problems with this year's team.
Yeah. It's a favorable... What's the thing where you remember something more favorably than you felt in the moment? Like, when you look back fondly on something that in the moment you weren't in love with, like, that's kind of what's happening with Mets fans. And I think mm-hmm. the viral video of Terry freaking out and...
Yeah.
That definitely...
It's like anytime you break up with someone...
Yeah, it's nostalgia.
It's nostalgia, but... That one came in a bad time because it leaked out the night that Mickey was ejected for the first time.
Yeah, that would have frustrated the hell out of me if I were
Mickey. Yeah, he was ejected in a calm, sane, rational way, and Terry was dropping some more. I mean, it was hilarious. I'm sorry. I wish we could just go all the way curse on this thing. Because it's like the funniest contrast was Neil Walker telling the umpire, Tom Hallion, well, if there had been any prior knowledge of this situation, Neil Walker's being like almost like over the top, geeky and professional, and then you hear a man who's 40 years older than him like, you, blah, 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 blah. And the other side, it was just hilarious.
So good.
But I don't know that translates in wins. I put out a call for Twitter questions. Let's see if we got any. Hashtag Shay Anything. Ed Marcus at LeGrand Rusty is the only one we've gotten since I put that out, and he wants to know what my thoughts are on Frank Zappa. Not really. I can appreciate his craft, okay. But I'm not really a fan. You?
Well, let's hear from...
Are you a fan of Frank Zappa?
Not especially.
He's probably asking both of us.
Let's toss to a Shay Hay. It's Tyler from Warwick, New York.
Hey, Doug and Andy. This is Tyler from Warwick, New York. I love the podcast, and I look forward to it every week. My question deals with how media members, such as beat writers or guys in the studio, who aren't per se fans but objective spectators to the game, what is a more interesting storyline to cover throughout a season? Is it the rarity of the 2015 Mets, which wasn't a team that was expected to contend just yet, but they pulled off the certain moves, or non-moves I should say, that carried them into an unexpected trip into the postseason and then eventually to the World Series? Or is it a season like this one with a new manager like Mickey Callaway with a team that's supposed to contend and gets off to a really hot start, but then drops off to one of the most disastrous and disappointing seasons that I can remember from until, you know, maybe 2007, 2008. Let me know what you guys think. And thank you for bringing such great content. Let's go Mets.
Well, thank you, Tyler.
Yeah, appreciate
the kind words.
Tyler.
You want to take it first?
Sure. I was just going to say that you can look back on periods like 2015 for the Mets and say, oh, that must have been such a great time to cover them. And everything was so positive. It's never really like that because there's mm-hmm. always... there's always issues, there's always controversy, there's always, I don't know, on a day-to-day basis, it's not as like a crazy fun a ride as it probably looks back, you look back on it as.
Right. Well, when the Mets are winning, you and I are not winning. So, it, you know, and we're not losing either. Yeah. We're just doing our jobs. So I guess if Tyler's question is it more interesting to cover winning or losing? I'd say it's sort of almost neither. You just want to cover interesting. Covering a team like the Mets in a big picture transition is actually very interesting.
Right.
Figuring out who their next GM is going to be, figuring out what direction they're going to go as a franchise. That's big time, big picture stuff that's fascinating to cover. Brutal to try to make something out of the games right now.
I'm not going to lie. I've not covered a boring Mets team yet.
They're not boring ever. They're weird
ever.
Like that. But right
there's
now,
roster moves every day and injury emails and
they're pushing it though. They're not an interesting team on the field right now. They're interesting off the field, mm-hmm. and they're more boring on the field than they've been in a long time. I think anyone would
after the
agree
trade
with
deadline.
That.
Maybe we'll get back to you, Tyler, because right mm-hmm. now we still have something to talk about every day with the Mets.
And that's all you ask for, win or lose.
Yeah.
I covered the 09, my first two beats, full-time beats, were the 09 Phillies, who went to Game 6 of the World Series, and the 2010 Mets, who ended up firing their manager and general manager, Omar Minaya, by the way, who's oddly running things again, but that's a whole other story. And I would say contrasting those two, the 2010 Mets were way more fun to cover because disasters can be naturally lend themselves to be more interesting. When everybody's happy, like they were at the 09 Phillies, it's like, hey guys, you won again today. Tell me about the win. Like, what the heck is so interesting to write about with that? But when it's like, oh, there was a meeting today and Jerry Manuel's pissed and da-da, this player's pissed at him and da-da-da, like, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, you and I do the sports nights after post games sometimes, and producers will come up and be like, hey, you want to talk about how great Gleyber Torres is? And it's like, well,
there's not much to say.
Sure, but you just talked about it.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You just said all there is to say.
Exactly.
And, yeah, so sometimes the storylines are better when there's some issues.
It just depends how interesting, because I think the Yankees right now are a good and interesting team, whereas, like, you've got the Stanton storyline, you've got the Sonny Gray stuff, you've got a lot of interesting Aaron Boone in his first year, who's a good, interesting character, very telegenic and someone interesting to talk about. So they're kind of good in a way that there's a lot to dig into. But I agree with you completely. It's like my least favorite talking point or story to write, whether I'm on TV or writing, is so-and-so hit two home runs. You just go, oh, man, like Carlos Beltran hit two home runs in this game. Well, Beltran's your column. What's my column? You know, yeah. He hit two home runs.
Other players so, are like, yeah, he's great.
So success isn't that interesting always. Not that we root against it. I just, you know, answered your question there, Tyler.
You mentioned Omar Minaya.
I did.
Let's talk about the GM search for the Mets, or lack thereof. Right now, it seems like John Rico's, at least, it seems like the point person from the outside. He's the guy meeting with the media. What is his status in terms of being the guy after this season, and where else are they looking?
Well, I get the sense informally that a lot of Mets fans assume that this GM search will be for show and that they'll end up just giving it to John Rico. I know a lot of people that hope that's the case because John Rico is so highly respected. People who work for him, people who work with him, people who have in the past worked with him are rooting for him to get this job, and understandably, if you knew the guy. But I do not see his chances as great. He may be the GM, but that ain't the way it's leaning right now. They're serious about finding a new voice from outside. You could make an argument that whatever Rico's capabilities are, it's time for someone to take a fresh look at this roster and this organization. I could see both sides of that argument, but he's not a favorite for this job. I would not call him the favorite for this job. The question is more, does he have a chance or not?
So what can he do to increase or decrease that chance this season?
Not a lot. I mean, they know him. They've known him for 15 years. So that's a great question. What can he do? I mean, he can orchestrate a really good trade or signing. He won't be in charge long enough to sign anybody. So he could try to orchestrate one of these good trades. But that doesn't always save you. Ruben Amaro ended up making a couple of good trades on his way out of Philly. And now he's the Mets' first base coach. So I don't know. It's a tough spot for him. What can he do? They know who John Rico is. The question is, can they come around to the idea that he's a GM? Or could be a GM? It's more on the decision makers than on Rico.
I sometimes picture this like, and tell me if I'm wrong with Rico, because this might be incorrect, but I always thought that your first job, like when you're at the bottom of the totem pole, not to say that's what Rico's been anywhere in the recent history, but when you start towards the bottom somewhere, it almost makes the most sense if you're going to get to the top to do it somewhere else. Do you think that's part of it, that everyone views John Rico as the guy under Sandy Alderson and they have a hard time seeing him as the guy?
Well, maybe, but that would be unfair because
I agree.
Yeah, he way predates Sandy Alderson.
I know.
He is viewed as part of the Alderson regime, which is nonsense. I mean, he was, but that's not who he is. He was a significant person in the Minaya regime towards the end, too. Of course, he has not been around for a ton of winning. And that's an argument against him, no matter how good he is or capable he is. My argument to that would be he has never been a decision maker, so he doesn't get credit for a lot of wins or blame for a lot of losses. He's never been in that chair. He's had a significant input for a long time. He's been a major person in that chain of command with the Mets for a long time. But, he's probably viewed somewhat as that, like just with a lot of jobs, right? Like you almost have to go through that dumb thing where you have to go away somewhere. You get an internship. And instead of them just hiring you, you have to go get a job somewhere else, and then they bring you back. But John Rico's 49 years old.
This metaphor only goes so far. You should be able to view him as just a resume. And if you're just looking at the resume, he's as qualified as anybody could possibly be.
He's actually, I think you could argue, uniquely qualified because he understands the specific skills having to do with dealing with New York media. He's good with, he's got a lot of experience in those situations. A GM in New York in a big market, in many ways a spokesman for a team, like a press secretary in addition to being a decision maker. And he is good at that. So he's got that. He knows how to deal with all the Mets internal office stuff that a new person would have to learn with because they'd be new to an environment. Mm-hmm. He's just universally respected by people who have dealt with him. But I think that having that stamp of being around for a long time and being around this year when it was really bad is going to be really difficult for him to overcome.
I keep wondering, and I want to get your opinion on this, about the stench. And I know that's a strong word. I don't even necessarily mean it to
coffee and deodorant.
But that's true. I did say before we started taping that I associate a certain smell with doing these podcasts, and it's because Andy mistakenly bought his wife Ruby bought him deodorant, and it's incredibly strong smell.
It was the wrong kind of Old Spice.
He smells like a teenager that you'd walk by in Abercrombie, but at the same time, so think of that smell, and then combine it with a fresh coffee. Like he gets coffee and he comes right in. So like steam coming out of his coffee. So that combination is what I smell when I do these podcasts. Anyway. The stench in terms of the Mets, and I'm wondering how it will affect 2019. Will they want to bring, and this kind of brings these two conversations together, will they want to bring the manager of the 2018 Mets to the 2019 Mets for no other reason? Because will there be doubt around it just because he was there for 2018 and the disaster that was this season? Will they want a GM that was around for 2017 and 2018? And will there be doubt around that for no other reason other than the fact that John Rico was around for 2017?
Well, it'd be reasonable to doubt. If you're a fan of the team, I understand going, like, why would you bring someone back who had anything to do with this? As of this moment, as of today, I think that it's the most likely thing is a GM from outside, same manager. That's how I would say that the next season probably starts. Mickey Callaway could be let go anytime by a new GM. That kind of gives a license. Hey, it's not my guy. So
right.
With Rico, that's one of the main things he has to overcome. Both Mets ownership being really used to him and Mets fans being really used to him. But I just come back to the fact that the people who he's one of the only people, the khaki and button-up shirt, like, baseball crowd, not the in-uniform crowd, that really impresses field people. Wally Backman, who had so little use for Sandy Alderson, I can't even tell you, and vice versa, respects John Ricco. It doesn't see him as a pencil pusher. Sees him as a guy who actually gets out there and listens to baseball men and listens to analytics guys. And so people like that would love to see what he could do, but there is that stench, and it ain't deodorant. It's the 2018 Mets.
By the way, much better than the alternative. I'd much rather you have
no deodorant.
Incredibly strong teenage boy wearing deodorant and not body odor.
I was at a wedding.
Because teenage boys are known for that, too.
I was at a wedding on a Saturday night that we didn't describe because it was 4th of July week. But what I would have told you about a recent Saturday night was I went to a wedding that was across the street from the Metropolitan Museum. Beautiful setting, magical night, except this young woman who was on the dance floor who sang this beautiful, like, aria thing at the ceremony had the worst BO I've, like, ever smelled. And she stunk up the whole dance floor and ruined the magic of looking at the Metropolitan Museum during a wedding.
You know what I've...
I hope she's not listening.
I hope so, too.
She's I not,
do happen
I
to
you.
Know that a lot of people, and I would say predominantly women, this is a very random Uh-oh. Fact that
Uh-oh.
I happen to know.
This can't possibly go in a bad direction.
No, I really don't think it will.
Okay.
Are faced with the reality that deodorant, according to a lot of scientists and doctors around the country, is the, one of the main causes of breast cancer.
Is that so?
Yes. So a lot of people try natural deodorant. But the problem with natural deodorant is that it doesn't make you smell good. it's healthy.
Oh, is that like that, like, what do they call it? Tim's or like Burt's Bees? Like
I don't
that
know
kind of
any
stuff?
Brand names of it. I just happen to know that.
I put on my wife's some of that stuff once because I didn't have any Old Spice.
Can
different
you make
time.
Your deodorant decisions for yourself?
I had really bad BO one day when I used like natural deodorant.
I buy my own deodorant.
Well, you're not, you live alone. Look, pal, if you're what, hey, what do you want? I'm picking up a prescription. What do you want from the CVS? Oh, I'm on a deodorant. It's not that crazy.
That was one of those comedic Jay in my ear goes, all right, we can move on here.
Yeah, so how it works in marriage
thanks.
If you're going on a shopping trip,
Sean
you can
Campbell
pick up
tweets,
stuff for each other.
I understand the Shanahan position on the Mets outlook for the next couple of years, but to improve that, what component should the team work on during the offseason? I understand Sean's question, but I think the answer is kind of everything.
Well, what's the Shea Anything position on the Mets outlook? Because I think we have different potential views.
I think that's what he's talking about.
That
he knows
just,
your position, he knows
oh, I
mine.
See. What component should the team work on during the offseason? It's a very good question. And I want to give a thoughtful answer. Do you have anything in mind while I'm thinking?
The biggest difficulty that I see this offseason is the amount of guys you can't move who are either not playing well right now or are hurt right now that will be on the team next year unless you figure out some miracle. Swarzak, Bruce, Frazier, Cespedes.
So work on getting really creative with moving two of those contracts.
Yeah, or else your team, it's going to be Groundhog Day, or else your team's going to look exactly the same next year.
The thing about a new GM coming in is that it gives you it's a unique opportunity to eat money, too, that... It's not like, hey, I didn't sign that guy. Can we please just clear the decks? You're not going to do that to every contract, but...
I don't know how you do that, though.
Sandy Alderson's first spring training, he released Luis Castillo and Oliver Perez, and they ate money. They had a ton of money on those two guys because, hey, I didn't sign them. Can we please just get rid of these clowns? That's kind of like the way that it goes. So there could be some of that.
I'm not saying necessarily that all of those guys deserve that treatment. I just am saying that I think most Met fans, if they were asked, would say, I want next year's team to look different either way, whether we rebuild or not. There shouldn't be a lot of familiar faces because back-to-back years we've had familiar faces and it hasn't worked. My main component that I would work on for the team would be that it looked different.
Yeah, which is going to, as you said, is going to be tricky.
Without trading.
They're locked in. Right. It's going to look... Well, if they do that, it'll just look worse. But, yeah, I mean, next year, it's going to be tricky. I mean, I think you have to find a way to get rid of two of Bruce, Frazier, Swarzak. I mean, I don't know. Certainly Vargas. That seems like a
Yeah, I can't believe I
cost.
Left him out.
Yeah.
That's probably the main one.
So there's a lot of sunk costs there. And boy, did I say in March that Sandy Alderson had a good offseason. Oopsie daisy.
Well, I thought he covered a lot of bases. I thought that he added a bunch of pieces, and I thought if everything went right, it would work. But the problem is that it's back-to-back years of hoping that everything goes right, and maybe it'll work, and it hasn't. So
yeah, Right.
It won't. It right. won't work if you do the same thing next year.
Oh, we were supposed to talk about the GM search with Nearing and
September. What's the latest with them finding
Well, to
outside?
Be clear, there aren't any names being floated to anyone by the Mets. They're so early in the process. So just a real quick procedural point. They're going to start interviewing in September is the plan now. This broad search that we talked about, I would certainly think they'd want someone in place by the GM meetings in November. Sandy Alderson, if you remember, was introduced after a broad GM search in late October of 2010, I believe. So that's a pace that you could look at. And they even have a little bit of a jump start on that because they didn't fire Manaea until the end of that season. So if they start in September, several weeks maybe from there, they'll have a new GM. There are no names that have, like, no factual names have been floated. So when we mention names, we're talking about people. Like, I sit down at the scout table or at the ballpark, or I am on a phone call with someone about something else, and we're just sort of shooting the breeze. And they go, but a real hot name there had been Tim Nearing, who's like former Red Sox infielder Brian Cashman's one of his top right-hand men in on the Yankees. That's like been more of a, hey, they should hire Tim Nearing. Hmm. And what I was catching a strong vibe of like Tim Nearing wouldn't leave the Yankees for the Mets because he's not particularly ambitious. He's not one of these guys that's like, I got to get a GM job. He's happy. I didn't put this in the story I wrote, but I believe he spends much of the baseball season living in the Cincinnati area with his kids. He's got kids that are still in some
beautiful
kind of
suburbs
school age.
In Cincinnati, by the way.
Lovely, whether you're on the Kentucky or the Southern Ohio side.
Both beautiful.
So that's not something that I see happening. And I don't know if I see the Mets wanting a Yankees person because of the animosity between the teams. Mm. So,
hey, don't you have a piece about all this on Mets blog right now?
It's on SNY.TV, yeah.
Is that this? Jason told me to plug it on Mets blog. Is that the same thing? I mean,
so,
Mets blog is on SNY.TV.
It is. No, it is. Let's continue the podcast.
Jay is absent in my ear.
Jay, where'd you go? Did you fall asleep?
Both are fine, he says. Okay, what'd you do on Saturday night?
I had a Doug Williams type Saturday night.
Oh,
I had a nice
boy.
Dinner with
I
a loved one.
I had the most Doug Williams, so this is going to be bad.
I was celebrating my 13th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
13 years of deodorant being delivered to you from the farm.
That's right. Yeah. So how it works on anniversaries is that you go to dinner.
Let's end there.
We went on. Yeah, fine. I'm not going to improve on that. But we went to this lovely, we discovered an incredible, like, boutique kind of hotel up in the Catskill Mountains and went away for 2.5 days. Which is the longest solo vacation we've had in years and will have for years to come, but it was lovely.
Ah, well, that sounds nice. I was down the Jersey Shore.
Oh, no, really? What a surprise.
I grilled some steak for my dad and I, and for my girlfriend and my mother, I grilled them some swordfish, and we had some corn on the cob, and we watched a documentary.
Did you prepare... Were you sort of emotionally in preparations for the big scoop in the New Canaan Gazette that was to come?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I was ready. I was prepared. I did the interview, after all, so I was expecting it to...
What a treasure trove of pictures of high school pitcher Doug Williams.
Yeah, if anyone is unaware of this, I did tweet out the link. A website from my hometown was nice enough to ask me some questions.
And your colleagues were nice enough to give you crap for it when it ran. It's perfectly innocuous.
Colleagues did give
piece.
Me some crap for it. There are just a couple pictures of me pitching in the column.
Bad delivery. Chris Sale-like in a bad way. Like,
oh, yeah,
elbows
I'm sorry.
Flying.
Chris Sale is so bad. You're
well,
right.
He's got that, like, his arm's going to hurt kind of delivery.
Yeah, that I was similar to Chris Sale, except
other than
in
results
no way whatsoever. Yeah. I was the rare high walk rate, low strikeout rate guy.
What documentary did you watch?
Well, I've been watching The Staircase, which I've told you about, which
yeah, you
should watch.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
And I actually was rewatching it because I finished it, but both my parents and my girlfriend were at the same spot in it, and I just kind of rewatched the whole thing with them. It was fun.
So there's two options, Doug, for you. There's the nice burger with a friend somewhere below 14th Street, and there's the Jersey Shore with the parents. And I'm glad to hear that you were...
I need to start doing some more
stuff. You really do. You're 27 years old.
And I live in New York.
Someday you'll be 37, and you'll probably live in a house somewhere, and you won't have so many options.
It's been pointed out to me that I live in this super cool and expensive neighborhood, and I really shouldn't.
It was my wife who talked you into moving to that neighborhood in part because she said, well, I can't tell this story.
Your wife is adventurous and does cool things, but I don't do anything. So I should just live in the cheapest neighborhood and just get a nice apartment.
Let's run through a few questions that came in late because I did solicit them. Any chance Mets trade Smith and Alonso and move Cespedes to first base? Probably not. But that's a fair question because they do have to look at how the hell do you get through the rest of this Cespedes contract.
Everyone's just going to play first base.
That's right. And it's going to be a very interesting shift. They're just going to line them all up.
Eight first basemen every day.
Any chance Wally Backman, I assume you mean, this from Ricky Leone, would get a chance at managing the team?
No.
Well, Sandy's gone. Hmm. Boy, if you want to look, I'm speaking out of school here, but if you want to galvanize your fan base when you've got a mediocre team, oh boy, would that
they
be the way to do
it. Love Wally Backman.
And I like Wally Backman.
Yeah, out of instinct, I said no because there was a rift between Wally and the front office.
Yes.
You know, John Harper just interviewed Wally a couple weeks ago.
Mets love it when John Harper interviews Wally. It's their favorite thing. Honestly, from Vlad, what would be the best organization to trade DeGrom? The Metsies should have DeGrom forever and always. They should sign him. That's what should happen.
All right, I disagree with that, but we have run out of time. It's the Shea Anything Podcast. Remember, just subscribe, rate, and review. Those are the things that help us if you like listening to this podcast. Thank you for listening either way. Doug Williams and Andy Martino, we will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.